This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video. Space, the final frontier.
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. I am Chuck Tomasi, and with me as always is Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I'm great on a nice Sunday afternoon.
Rumors of our death have been greatly exaggerated. We are here to bring you another special episode of Technorama. Yay. Dr. Pamela Gay is an American astronomer, educator, podcaster, and writer. Best known for her work on astronomical podcasting, she currently works with Fraser Cain in co-hosting Astronomy Cast. In 2002, she received her PhD in astronomy at the University of Texas in Austin. Today, her main affiliation is visiting assistant professor of physics at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. There, she teaches introductory physics and astronomy courses. She is also on the Council of American Association of Variable Star Astronomers. That's why I'm not on the council. I can't even say it.
That's right.
As well as its Educational Committee Chair. Oh, awesome. We last spoke with Pamela in 2005 when Technorama was first getting started, and she hosted a popular podcast called Slacker Astronomy. It's been 3 years. We thought it was time to catch up. So it's our pleasure to once again speak with Dr. Pamela Gay. Welcome back, Pamela.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Chuck. It's great to be speaking with you again.
And we listen to you all the time. Loved Slacker Astronomy. Love Astronomy Cast even more. So let's back. Oh, Craig, you said you had the first question. So fire away.
I did. I wanted to ask you. I'm an Aquarius. So what do you see for my sign?
No.
Well,
astronomy, not astrology. You nitwit.
Yeah. No.
Duh. Okay, sorry. That changes the whole course of this interview. I'm just kidding.
He's going to go scratch down some new questions.
Scratch that one. No, okay. So go ahead, Chuck. You go with the first one.
Well, tell the listener how you got your interest, you got your start in astronomy.
Oh, wow. That's one of those things that usually leads to like my life story, because I actually don't remember a time when I didn't enjoy astronomy. One of my very first memories is lying to my dad that I could see cosmonauts walking their dogs on the moon, because we had a little tiny backyard telescope, and he let me get away with the lie, and I've been hooked ever since.
Well, now nobody at work is going to believe you.
That's right.
Well, luckily the Russians aren't actually walking dogs on the moon, so it's really not a story I think I need to tell truthfully at any point in my life.
Not yet. Well, I wanted to ask you about I saw you had some involvement with amateur astronomy. How involved are you with that? Are you still and in what way?
Well, I am at a small university and don't actually have any telescope access of my own right now. And in order to do observational astronomy, I have to rely on two different things. One is online archive data, and I use the Sloan Digital Sky Survey a fair amount. But the other thing that I can do is turn to the amateur astronomy community and say both, hey, can you go out and proactively look at this really cool star that I'm interested in? Or, hey, while you're out there looking at things, if you find something really cool, can you point it out to me and let's write a research paper on what you find? There are some amazing amateur astronomers out there who are doing CCD observations using commercial digital cameras to observe the sky night after night after night. And they're uncovering stars that are behaving in weird ways that no one previously knew about. And rather than letting them keep this information secret among themselves, I'm working to try and take and publish their results. Right now, I'm working with a great guy by the name of Jerry Smolik, who is leading an entire team of amateur astronomers.
Well, do you think, you kind of alluded to what my next question was, Do you think that equipment's coming down in price and whatnot, or maybe just people being a little more inventive with how they're using some technology? Do you think it's becoming a little more accessible to the regular, you know, backyard astronomer?
It's a little bit of both. They say that an avid hobbyist will spend as much on their hobby as they'll spend on your car. So if you take someone who has a $15,000 car and give them a $15,000 hobby, well, you can get some really good astronomy equipment for that much.
Boy, are we underpowering our podcast.
I know.
We're downsizing our podcast. What are you talking about?
But this is over the course of a lifetime. And unlike computers, which you have to throw out after 3 or 4 years, with an amateur astronomer, first you buy in and you get the really nice telescope for $3,000. Then a few years later, you get the really nice mount for $10,000. And over the course of a lifetime, you build up a backyard observatory that, in the case of many amateur astronomers, is better than what small universities have to offer their students and faculty. So I get great data from people who have a car's worth of astronomical equipment in their backyard.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about that. It almost makes sense that the amateurs, they may or may not know what they're looking at, but they could be effective data gatherers for the research scientists who do know how to interpret that information.
And this is something that's going on broadly across astronomy. With my work with the American Association of Variable Star Observers, there's actually several professional observers that we rely on this group of amateurs to get us the data we need to allow us to apply for more time, to back up data that's being taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. Because if you're a professional astronomer looking at a nova and you want to use the Hubble Space Telescope to see how it's behaving when it's not in its nova-like really bright phase, you need the amateurs on the ground watching it, because if it does go nova and Hubble looks at it, you're going to sort of burn out Hubble's detectors. So it's this great symbiotic relationship where the amateurs are contributing to real science and the pros are getting the data they need and everyone gets warm fuzzies. It's just a great relationship.
That does sound like a great way to do it. We mentioned AstronomyCast. Could you give the listener a little bit of information about what it's all about, as if the title wasn't self-evident?
Well, our tagline is that we take a facts-based journey through the cosmos. Each week, Fraser and I take on a new topic. We've gone everywhere from the planets of the solar system to how the universe is someday going to end and how it all began so many billion years ago. And we discuss things based on how do we know what we know? What is the history behind getting to our present day understanding of astronomy and physics? There's a lot of content out there. And when you first say, well, the center of the galaxy, blah-dee-blah-dee-blah, and make some declaration, well, people will often respond with, well, how do you know that? And we're there to answer the question of how do we know?
We watch Doctor Who.
Well, yeah. That too, I have to admit that we both probably do watch Doctor Who, but those aren't exactly the facts.
So do you look at that and go, okay, let's suspend physics for a bit, or has he got it pretty close on based on what we know today?
Yeah, no, Doctor Who is just pure science fiction, glorious badness. I'm a fine connoisseur of bad sci-fi, and I love Doctor Who.
Well, that's like when we asked Dr. Michio Kaku, can he suspend his, suspend belief when he's watching science fiction? Can you do that for Star Trek, you know, when they're flying around different planets? I guess some of those planets don't exist, or do they?
The solar system that Spock comes from has actually been discovered. The star Eta Errandi, it does have planets, and that's kind of cool, but I have to admit, it's much easier to suspend disbelief when they go totally off their rocker, when they're just making up particles, making things up. It's when they get the small stuff wrong that it's really annoying. Like, I recently saw Iron Man, which I really enjoyed, except when you have this dude plummeting from the sky toward the planet, as Phil Plait put it, momentum is still conserved, and you'd have slime of human inside the Iron Man armor when he impacted the planet Earth. Humans do squish.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's just the little things that get wrong that sort of break my brain. I'm bad to watch sci-fi with.
Hey, well, on Star Trek, they had inertial dampeners, so maybe that's when he had some in his suit.
And Heisenberg compensators. Don't forget those.
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't see him making those in a cave.
Tony Stark can do it. Come on. Yeah. So I have to ask you, what happened to slacker astronomy?
There were life changes. Aaron is now a PhD student at Tufts University. Mm-hmm. I got married and moved cross country. And in taking a position at a university, I had to be more careful with the role model I was to my students. And so we just had different directions that we wanted to go with our two different productions. So Astronomy Cast is the type of thing that my university can get behind. And it's nice working within the context of a university because we have our 501c3 status through the university. We can hire undergraduates to work with us. So it's just a different model of doing podcasting.
What do your students think of that?
The funniest reaction I think I got was there was one point my first or second semester at Southern Illinois where we were listed in the What's Hot in iTunes right underneath a Lindsay Lohan Mean Girls promotion. I had to show this to my students because it was the funniest thing that I've ever been a part of, having a production I do listed next to Lindsay Lohan under What's Hot. And one of my students went home and told their parents, and their parents accused them of lying because what professor would be doing something like that? And they got prove their parents wrong. And that was a moment of pride on my case.
So you can't write that stuff. You can't make that up.
No. I think my students are a little bit proud about the fact that, hey, this is one of our professors who's reaching out to the world. And it shows that you can do things that affect the world, even though you're just working in small town America. And that's kind of cool.
That is the coolest part. It doesn't matter if you're a rock star or not. You can reach out and be global on a very modest budget.
That's what podcasting's all about.
Exactly. And we're having fun reaching out to the world. It's great getting emails from people, Saudi Arabia, Japan, England, everywhere.
Belgium.
Yeah. They're out there listening and they're responding and they're learning. And that's the coolest part.
The President of the United States is dead. He was murdered in the morning sunlight by a 4-year-old boy. So began J.C. Hutchins' Seven Son audiobook trilogy, the most popular podcast novel series in history. Last December, the trilogy concluded. The heroes were triumphant, or so we think. But now, it's time to go back and reveal moments in the Seventh Son story that were merely hinted at in the original trilogy. Welcome to Seventh Son Obsidian. J.C. Hutchins has opened up his Seventh Son universe and invited the seven biggest names in podcast fiction to chronicle a nationwide blackout that rocked America during the Seventh Son trilogy. Seventh Son Obsidian features short stories from these award-winning and nominated authors: Michael A. Stackpole, Scott Sigler, T. Morris, Murr Lafferty, Matt Wallace, Mark Yoshimoto Nemkov, and Christiana Ellis. And even more tales from these trailblazing podcast entertainers: Evo Terra, Dan Klass, Wichita Rutherford, George Probb, TD0013, Soccer Girl, and the cast of the Radio Adventures of Dr. Floyd. Obsidian also features dozens of audio and video recordings, stories of the blackout as told by its victims, created by Seventh Son fans across the globe. On May 31st, the lights go out. America becomes a police state. Because when the power fails, chaos reigns. Subscribe now to Seventh Son Obsidian or catch up with the original Seventh Son Trilogy experience at jchutchins.net.
I just found out that 2009 is the International Year of Astronomy. What is that all about?
Well, the goal is to give every person in the world an experience with astronomy. And I'm a part of this. I'm actually part of the United States staff to make this happen. And the plans that we have are everything from observing campaigns to dark sky initiatives to there'll be a 365 days of astronomy podcast created to new citizen science initiatives along the lines of Galaxy Zoo, but spread out to new science topics to, low-cost telescope kits that people can build at home. You name it, we're going to try and create it. There's even going to be Second Life astronomy observing experiences.
Oh, wow.
And art displays and all sorts of different things, such that even the geek at home who refuses to see the stars at night will have the stars inflicted upon them as they wander around in virtual worlds and
thrust upon
mothers,
them
like a gamma ray burster hitting you in the eye.
Right. And we're going to do things like in guerrilla astronomy, where amateur astronomers armed with telescopes will set up in grocery store parking lots and inflict the nearest star, our sun, on mothers with their kids as they try and go and buy eggs. And
psst, want to have a peek?
Come on, try it just once. The first one's free.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what we're going to try and do. Astronomy is addictive. And if we reach enough people, perhaps we can get people thinking about the stars as a resource and going out and looking up at night versus lighting up their houses at night. And
yeah. Hey, I want to throw an interjector here. Now, speaking of which, I think some tools kind of help that out a little bit. Have you seen Stellarium and... what's the other one where it's like the open source program that shows you the stars at night and the constellations and whatnot?
Stellarium is the one that I use the most. And there's also things like Heavens Above that allow you to know what satellites are overhead, and the Clear Sky Clock, which allows you to know, well, is it actually worth going outside tonight or not? And we're going to be working to bring these different software packages together and to build new tools through a project called Portal to the Universe, which is coming out of the European Space Agency and the European Southern Observatories in Garching, Germany. It's going to be a central website that pulls together every online resource we can find and also builds yellow pages of astronomers, so that if you want to find out, well, where's the nearest telescope dealer? Where's the nearest amateur astronomy club? You just tell it where you are and it tells you where to go look. So there's some massive tools. These are cornerstone projects to the International Year of Astronomy that are being put together to help bring together resources in one central place. The internet is almost as big as the universe, and we're going to try and create a good directory for it.
Where is a good place to go find out more about the International Year of Astronomy and what's going on there?
Well, here in the United States, you can go to astronomy2009.us. It's our website. And at the international level, there's astronomy2009.org.
Wonderful. I'm going there right now. Oh, when we're done.
Yeah, when we're done. Mike Chuck.
And if you're an amateur astronomer interested in helping support things, drop me an email. And I'm actually the person in charge of making sure the website gets updated, so I can get your information on the U.S. website.
Cool. Now, and I mentioned Stellarium in there a moment ago, but what about, I assume that this came out, what, maybe for next year, but the Worldwide Telescope from Microsoft, have you had a chance to look at that, or are you involved with that at all?
I have to admit that I haven't played in it very much yet. I have a collaborator who's worked with it a lot, Adrian Gauthier, down at the University of Arizona, and it's been designed very carefully to allow different observatories around the world to integrate their data into it using a set of metadata tags that have been carefully designed by astronomers to help make it easier to integrate data. Between that and Google Sky, I think there's going to be a way for anyone who wants to access the sky to do it in a way that they enjoy. These are two great tools that are designed in two very different ways, where Google Sky is great for networking, and Microsoft's new product is being designed to help integrate images from the professional observatories.
Yeah, because not only in a different way to enjoy it, but also in a way we've never been able to do this before.
Yeah, it's the internet is allowing us to work toward having virtual worlds where we can socially network our data, our ideas, everything in one place. What's really cool about the skinnable layers and the way that you can interact with both of these great tools is big professional observatories or small backyard observatories can get in and integrate their ideas and integrate their data so that we can look up and see what's going on right now. One of the International Year of Astronomy projects that's going on is what we call Astro Twitter, which is going to allow people, instead of saying...
No more Twitter, please. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, this is different. Instead of asking, sure, what are you doing, it asks, what are you looking at? Now, imagine looking at Google Sky and seeing, wow, Hubble Space Telescope's currently looking at Pluto, currently looking at the Orion Nebula.
Sure.
And then you with your backyard telescope can point at exactly what Hubble's looking at the same time. And you know what Hubble's looking at because of Astro Twitter.
I have to ask, this is on behalf of our friend T. Morris, which I'm sure you may have heard of him somewhere on the internet. He wanted to slip in a proxy question. What is your opinion on Pluto being labeled a planet or not? His argument was that baby Einstein, specifically baby Galileo, says it is. So that's
no,
hard to argue
it's
with.
It's not a planet. Really, it's not. Here's the best way to think of it. Imagine that some alien dude flies along and is happily cleaning up the Milky Way galaxy and sorting things into boxes for storage later. They'd swoop into our solar system, look down on it, and go, ah, there's some rocky planets, and pick up Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars and throw them in a box. We'd happily go, there's a bunch of asteroids, throw them in a box. We'd go, oh, there's some gaseous objects, and pick up Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, throw them in a box. And then all these icy things, the comets, Pluto, Sedna, all of these icy chunks in the outer solar system, they'd go, oh, these are all similar objects, and throw them in a box. Well, since Pluto's not getting thrown in a box planet by my fictional alien who's cleaning up the galaxy, it doesn't match with the rest of the planets. It's clearly something that is geophysically part of the icy bodies, not part of the planets. It's a sad truth, but Pluto just went and got itself reclassified by not hurrying up and consuming all the other icy things gravitationally. It was just too small to defend itself.
There you go, T. You have to have Serena put her toys in the right boxes now.
Yeah, that's right. Or no, you do it for her.
Personal question. If you could study one type of object in the sky, be it a star or something else, what would be your focus of interest?
If you were stuck on an island... And you can only take
one. You can only point your telescope at one thing.
I'm only allowed one object. Oh dear.
What's your favorite cosmological object?
See, I'm really into things that are evolving, and the problem is everything's evolving if you look at them long enough. So I guess to me, solving Aralari stars is sort of like going out and solving cosmic Sudoku problems. There's only one set of periods that'll solve a given star for a given period of time. And if I'm trashed on an island with nothing to do, solving a whole bunch of variable stars would at least keep me busy.
Well, what is a variable star, and why are they important then?
Well, Shakespeare got it right. Our stars are inconstant objects. If you watch them, they change in brightness over time. And in general, you have to look at a star like the sun for billions of years to start catching these changes. But there is a certain range of temperatures and brightnesses where stars become unstable gravitationally, and they contract down to try and find a nice balancing point and end up overheating and then expand back out. And these stars, for a few million years in their life, will, by several percent, get smaller and bigger over several hours to several days. So the Aralari stars that I like to look at, these are stars that basically contract and expand over a half-day interval. And by studying the way they do this, we can start to understand what is the density of these stars and how is that density changing with time. This is a direct measure of how the stars are evolving. We can watch a star change over the course of a human lifetime. There's very few objects that you can do that with. Variable stars are one of the few things that you can use to say, wow, I can see this star change, and I've done it over my career. And that's just kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. How do we measure the distances to the stars?
Oh, that depends on the star. With the nearest stars, it's a matter of triangles. You look at it in June, see where it is relative to background quasars, look at it again 6 months later in December, see where it is relative to background quasars. And you can actually see the nearest stars move slightly relative to the distance. Most distant objects. This is the same thing as if you hold your thumb out at arm's length and look at it relative to a distant mountain range with first your left eye and then your right eye. You'll actually see your thumb appear to move relative to those background mountains. Now, your thumb didn't actually move. What moved was the perspective that you were looking at it from. And just as your eyes are in two different locations, the Earth is in two different locations when it's on one side of the sun and another. And we know the size of that baseline. We know the distance from where the Earth is in June to where it is in December. And so that's one side of a triangle. And then we can measure the angle that the star appears to move the same way your thumb appears to move. And then it just becomes a trig problem. And that works for the nearest stars. Mm-hmm. For the more distant stars, we rely on, well, we know that this type of star is this actual luminosity. And if we know how much light an object is giving off and we know how bright it appears, we can then use complicated math to figure out how distant it is. The same way, if you're looking at a motorcycle headlight, you know that if it's really bright, you're about to get hit. And if it's rather faint, the motorcycle's off in the distance somewhere. So with stars, we look and see how bright they appear. If we know how luminous they actually are, we can calculate the distance.
Now, along those same lines, that's kind of how you tell when you're actually detecting planets around stars too, kind of observing the properties of the star, because I've heard of them seeing them wobble, you know, or something like that, to know that there's something going around it. Is it similar kind of vein?
Not quite. So,
okay.
No, actually, it's entirely different. So the luminosity is just a measure of, okay, I know how, I just measure how bright something is. It's some number. With looking for the gravitational wobble induced by planets, this is a different technology. We use what are called spectra. And starlight, all the different colors have specific numbers, specific wavelengths associated with them.
Okay.
And any given atom will absorb and emit light at specific colors, specific wavelengths. So when we look at stars using spectra, we can see these dark lines in their light where a given atom is absorbing all the light. Maybe it's iron doing the absorption. Maybe it's hydrogen doing the absorption. And we know exactly what number those lines should line up with. But just like a fire truck whizzing past you will appear to have a change in the pitch of the sound, it mm-hmm. doesn't actually have a pitch change. It
Doppler
just
shift.
Sounds like it does.
Yeah.
It's the Doppler shift. So if you were on that fire truck, it would sound like it was making the same noise all the time. But to the poor person on the sidewalk getting their ears blasted, it sounds like it's first getting higher pitched and then lower pitched.
Right.
When we look at stars' light, we see the light get shifted the same way depending on the motion of the star. So if a star is whizzing toward us, all those specific colors of the absorption lines get shifted to the blue. And if the star is whizzing away from us, they get shifted to the red.
Here's where I stick in one of those dummies tips and go, you know how kids, you know how you remember that? When you see the back end of a car, the taillights are red, it's moving away from you. Now you can tell the difference between red shift and blue shift.
That's entirely true. Now, this works even with really small motions. So you can kind of imagine a fire truck going back and forth up and down your block very quickly. It would be highly annoying. And you'd get this cyclic, the sound gets higher pitched, gets lower pitched, gets higher pitched, gets lower pitched. Well, if you have a planet going around a star, its gravitational tug will cause the star to go back and forth in the sky. And so we can see this, the light gets red shifted, the light gets blue shifted, the light gets red shifted, the light gets blue shifted as the planet goes round and round and round.
That's got to be difficult because if you think of somebody observing our star and, you know, the tug that, say, Jupiter has on it, the the orbit is, you know, 50, 60, 80 years on some of these planets. They've got to be, you know, watching these things for decades, wouldn't you think? Or are they, are they observing, are they first finding the stars that have massive planets close?
That's exactly what's happening. It's the biggest back and forth motions that we see come from having giant planets, even bigger than Jupiter, closer into their star than Mercury is to our sun. And these giant stars that are very close in can create motions of a few meters per second, which is sort of the speed of a person walking or running. We have technology now that we can detect a star moving through space as fast as a human being walks. And that's kind of cool to think about, just imagining the precision of a human being walking across space. That's a speed we can detect.
And that's pretty good.
Yeah. And so when you have a star that's basically going at the speed of a square dancer as it do-si-dos with its companion planet, we can measure that. And and we have been, and we found over 200 planets this way.
I just had all kinds of square dancing images going through my head.
Yeah.
But that's the actual set of speeds that these objects are moving in.
Now, I'm sure, like Carl Sagan has, you know, explained in the past about there being billions and billions of stars and billions of planets around those stars.
He never actually said that, by the way.
Well, you know what I mean. It doesn't matter. Myth or not, that's true. Okay, so my question to you is, and the Vatican recently said that it's okay for Catholics to believe in alien life forms out there. Do you?
I believe that there is alien life out there. I'm not sure that there's intelligent life close enough for any of us to ever find it. But as Carl Sagan said, it's an awful waste of space.
Yeah.
And
that's what he said, Chuck.
But it's easy to end up with an environment that a microbe can live in. Microbes really aren't picky. They'll live just about anywhere.
Sure.
And I'm sure that there's microbes on other objects here in our own solar system, even if it's just microbes that we put there by crashing things on other planets. Now,
there are now.
Yeah. Sorry, now, Mars.
The idea of intelligent aliens actually opens up some fascinating ideas for science fiction. There's actually an excellent book called The Sparrow about Jesuits self-funding a missionary mission to go visit an alien civilization prior to the commercial space agencies and governmental space agencies being able to afford it. And just imagine what happens to all the fundamentalist religious groups when we discover there are aliens out there, and what are the consequences to, did they eat from the apple of wisdom, or all of these different things. Really, I don't want intelligent life to be found in my lifetime, because I think the political upheaval is just more than I really want to live through. But that's me.
I'm scared that they'll put me in my place. Sorry.
Now, the universe is a big place. There's room for other intelligence, but it's probably far away and beyond our ability to communicate with.
The introduction of microbes to another body, just, I'm thinking of the Drake equation, and what would that be? The whoops factor?
The whoops factor.
Yes. Well, this actually goes in with the whole idea of, well, if there is intelligent life out there, it should have gotten here by now, just if you imagine it star hopping from system to system. Well, it could just be we're the first ones that are starting to send our microbes to other planets, and it could just be the beginning of that process, and the beginning of that process is us sending the flu to Mars because someone sneezed on the wrong probe.
Don't come to work if you're not feeling well at NASA, I guess.
Yeah, right.
Well, we have had somewhat evidence of Martian rocks on Earth, you know, and life being inside it, right?
It's a very controversial result.
Right.
There was an asteroid found asteroid's the wrong word. There was a rock from space found in Antarctica about a decade ago, I think, mm-hmm. that when they cut it open and gold plated it, and here's the catch, when they gold plated it and then put it under a scanning electron microscope, they saw structures that resembled nanobacteria, like people have found in Yellowstone and in other hot springs on the planet Earth. Now, I've heard some people say it was strictly an error in how it was gold-plated. I've heard some people say that this was a natural mineral growth, not something that required microbes. And I've heard people say, it must be microbes. I think there's room for us to say we don't know what it was. That the possibility exists that it could have been nanobacteria, but there are other equally valid interpretations of the data.
Sure.
The third annual Parsec Awards are a celebration of excellence in speculative fiction podcasting. Nominations are open through June 15th. Please visit www.parsecawards.com to find out how to nominate your favorite speculative fiction podcasts. That's www.parsecawards.com.
Now, the Large Hadron Collider, I presume you're following the news on that.
Oh, I can't wait for it to fully work. It's cool.
What is your interest, or what are you hoping to get out of that?
Well, currently there's a whole lot of particle physicists scattered around the planet, each declaring that they have solved how particles work throughout all of quantum mechanics, string theory, yada, yada, yada. And without the Large Hadron Collider, all they can do is stand on their chairs and holler at the rest of the planet that they're right. With the Large Hadron Collider, we can actually start to test their theories. What a novel and wonderful concept. We can look for the Higgs boson. We can figure out, well, how is it that gravity is conveyed? How is it that mass is given to particles? We can start to make sense of the things that are still mysteries within physics but are very fundamental to day-to-day life. The Higgs boson is the reason that I can sit in this chair and feel overweight after eating too large of a breakfast, because it gives my particles mass.
Darn you.
Exactly. Now, if only I could repulse those little bosons.
You're right.
But we haven't detected this most fundamental of particles yet, and the Large Hadron Collider will hopefully do that, and hopefully it will also start to be able to hit on the lightest weight of the supersymmetric particles and will tell us, is supersymmetry the correct interpretation of particle physics? Is string theory the correct interpretation of particle physicists? There are going to be careers made and broken in the next few years by that new and wonderful set of instruments. And it's a great time to watch particle physics, and perhaps not the best time to be a particle physics theorist, because, well, you can't hide any longer. The data will get you.
You were recently in Europe. What's going on over there?
Oh, I was actually over there working to start new collaborations on two different projects with the European Space Agency and European Southern Observatory. They sort of share a press office along with the International Astronomical Union. Mm-hmm. One very triply owned press office that is basically the headquarters for the International Year of Astronomy under Pedro Russo and Lars Lindbergh Christensen. And I was over talking to them about, well, how do we develop this portal to the universe, this new media gateway to everything that's online about astronomy? We want to be an index. We want to be a place that widgets live. We want to be a place that press releases come out, so that it's essentially a one-stop shop for anyone looking to get online content. We hope to go live with a beta site in November, and I was over in Europe working with Lars to try and figure out, well, what resources do we need? How do we get started? And, you know, if any of you out there want to donate to help make this process possible, Lars Lindbergh Christensen at ESA, lars@esa.org, I'm sure would be more than willing to take your money to help make this dream a reality. I also went over to Oxford to work with Chris Lintott, who's the PI behind Galaxy Zoo and one of the folks who does BBC's The Sky at Night. He's co-host to Sir Patrick Moore, and he and I are working on ways to help bring more images to the public and ask the public to help us understand them. There have been some great serendipitous discoveries made. For instance, the avalanche that was found on Mars, that was someone looking at the images for a totally different reason and went, wait, we caught an avalanche. Well, if we get the public pouring through these archives of images, they're going to be able to find dust devils. They're going to be able to find avalanches. They're going to be able to find all sort of cool new features. And so he and I were just brainstorming, well, what are the things that we can do by getting the public looking at images?
Oh, you just covered like six more topics I want to run down rabbit trails with you on.
It's a four-hour interview.
All of these things are going to hopefully become a reality. We're right now at the looking for funding stage. Between now and November, we need to come up with a bunch of money. So if any of you out there, we're looking for corporate sponsors at this point, get in touch with me and I can tell you how to donate money in a tax-deductible way to make all these things become real.
Cool. So what's next for the superstar, Dr. Pamela Gay? Are you going to be busy on the 25th of this month? You know it's the 25th, right?
Towel Day.
Not the Towel Day.
Isn't that Towel Day?
The Phoenix Lander on Mars.
Yes. Thank you. I have Google Calendar programmed to remind me of what my life is supposed to be like. And today I'm committing genocide on tent caterpillars. That's the very next thing on my calendar is ridding my apple tree of tent caterpillars.
Oh. Poor thing.
Yeah, it happens and they die. So Phoenix Lander, I love this mission. It's the Mars Polar Lander given a second shot a few orbits later. And hopefully this time it will land a little bit more safely. And then we have two more launches coming up. This is such a rich time for spacecraft. We have STS-124 going up May 31st, and then GLAST is hopefully going to be launching on June 3rd. And then a giant meeting of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, the American Astronomical Society, and the Planning Committee for the International Year of Astronomy is going to be happening June 1st through the 4th here in St. Louis. So the next 3 weeks of my life are basically owned by the astronomy community and planning for these meetings. And I have a student who's going to go see STS-124 launch and cover it for Astronomy Cast Live.
Ooh,
so
nice.
It's a really exciting time.
We tried to do that, but didn't work out. Our correspondent, Craig, didn't. The timing was off.
I was there. I was in Florida, and that was on Wednesday. They were going to launch it. They scrubbed it, and then I said, "Oh, I can actually go to the Friday one." So I drove across Florida, got over there, sat down in my chair. They canceled it.
Oh, yeah. I'm so worried about that happening to my poor student. He's going out and he's actually conned his 12-year-old brother and his either dad or uncle. He's still trying to find a responsible adult. are going to go out and watch. And it's just such a great experience we're running out of space shuttle launches. There's going to be a span of time when the United States isn't launching human beings anymore. And this may be the last time, these next few launches, that we're going to be able to watch human beings launch from a facility in the United States for the stars. I suspect that Spacecraft 2, Virgin Galactic's project, is probably going to get its act together and start launching humans before NASA gets its Orion program together. And it's a melancholy time to go watch the space shuttle launch. So go watch it launch while you still have a chance.
That's right.
Got to get there. Before we dive into the ending of this show, because we are officially out of questions here, I wanted to play you one thing, speaking of the Hadron Collider.
Excited about the news surrounding the Large Hadron Collider? Want to get in on the action with your own subatomic discoveries but can't get to Geneva, Switzerland all that often? Now you can do the same experiments as the professional physicist with HADI, the Little Hadron Collider from WAMCO.
What?
HADI is the perfect gift for any physicist or people who just like to play with potentially dangerous things. Just 1 meter in diameter and operating on a single 9-volt battery, Patty allows the scientist in your family to look for things like the elusive Higgs boson. Just add ice cubes in the hopper and salt water in the reservoir, then flip the switch. Through a series of systems like the Mini Proton Synchrotron, the Super Mini Proton Synchrotron, and the Technorometron, your little Hattie can start to unlock the secrets of the universe right in your own home. And Hattie doesn't cost billions and take over a decade to assemble like the Large Hadron Collider. Hattie assembles in minutes and is available for just 3 easy payments of $99.95. Order your little Hadron Collider today. Shipping and handling not included. 9-volt battery sold separately. Warning, people with pacemakers should not use the little Hadron Collider.
Beautiful.
So where do I sign up to get a classroom set?
Yeah.
The lab environment.
Oh, if only it were that simple. Oh, that could be fun.
We're still working on that Technorometron piece.
Yeah. Yeah. If you ever come across anybody that needs to name something like that, let us know, you know, throw our name out there.
Naming rights.
Yeah.
Pamela, we could go on for hours about all this cool stuff and recent discoveries, but unfortunately, we don't have limited hard drive space, so we're going to have to get back with you again real soon. It's been a real treat.
Anytime.
Thanks. It's been a real treat for us, and thank you for joining us. Can you remind the listener again where to find you and your podcast?
Our podcast can be found at www.astronomycast.com. And I also have a personal blog at starstrider.com, and that's Strider spelled with a Y.
Kind of like spindle.com. Sounds familiar, Craig?
Yeah, that's my website. I don't know why I spelled it with a Y, but whatever.
Yeah, it happens, and then you spend the rest of your life saying with a Y.
Yeah, or spelling out my domain name.
And we thank you, the listener, for giving us your time once again on this special episode of Technorama. If you're listening directly from the website, consider subscribing to get the show automatically delivered to you for free. You can find out more information on the main webpage at chuckchat.com. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with all the great audio content over at farpointmedia.net. Go over there to discover all the good stuff. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can call in the U.S. 206-222-2428 to get on the listener line, or put Chuck Chat in your Skype buddy list and leave us a message there. Send us an email, that's technorama@chuckchat.com, or visit the website and leave a comment on the blog. You can find that at chuckchat.com/technorama. Are you sensing a theme here? We would love to hear from you. Until next time, tell a friend about Technorama, and head over to astronomycast.com. Make sure you have a listen. Craig, do you remember how to do this ending?
Actually, I'm going to throw it to Pamela.
A binary high five.
Oh, 101.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Lenny dropped the cue card.